Terry said he was going to tee it up for me pretty good today, and I do appreciate him. He did outline a great deal of challenges, a great deal of other opportunities. Now, think of it as a beef guy coming at this to an agronomy meeting, because I'm a beef cattle producer. I do beef cattle research on management production and genetics and forages. So I'm taking it a different direction than an agronomist doing this, but I'm trying to break in as a beef cattle producer into the semi-arid cropping systems of the triangle, where we're trying to replace any kind of fallow to graze that. A little bit about Perry's talk, and it's really great that he did tee that up. If you look at Hill County and you saw those grazing acres, what he didn't tell you about Hill County is that's where the forage and the water resources meet. I mean, a cow can go 2 to 3 miles a day to get water, but when you're looking at crops in a crop fallow scenario, it may be 4 miles or 8 kilometers to water, even though we see those grazings within close proximity of that. So we have to think about that. And if there is water in that Golden Triangle area, there's a good chance it has anti-nutrient compounds like its high sulfates or high iron, and so you can't use that necessarily as a livestock production. So I took this, and our team took this as a way to look at it from a beef cattle perspective. Trust me, every beef cattle producer in the triangle that's diversified has both crops and cattle realize that they're low input, both wheat and crop, or cows. So if they can graze that stubble, or they can graze regrowth, or whatever, they're going to do it without hurting their yields in wheat. My feeling is I've been in the triangle since the early 90s. I think one of the reasons that I think in my mind that no-till and chem fallow was adapted so readily in that area is that it was equipment change. There was not a drag in yield, no wheat drag in yield. So essentially, as producers could afford it, they brought in new equipment to make that change. To put cover crops on this, we're pretty sure that if we're going to use that banked moisture or that banked soil moisture that we're using to grow an annual cover crop or something on that in the off year, we're going to see a drag in wheat. So how much of that value is how I approach it? Can a beef cattle either use or pay to get that producer to make an incentive to make that either a continuous cropping or not? Little bit about how we did that. Apologize. Thank you. There you go. So what we did is in our research design is we had various species of cover crops where we concentrated on 5 cool season polycultures. We had 5 warm season polycultures and 5 polycultures that were a mix of the cool and warm. We took those large-scale plots and then split them and looked at various we call them termination methods. It's an economic endpoint. One where we sprayed the cover crop out and returned 100% of that biomass to the soil to represent a true cover crop. We're trying to get those benefits that we see and had good outstanding talks the past 2 days with. Then we took in mowing and baling. We took it as if there is no water or everywhere documented in the triangle where cattle can't graze these. There's no options. But we know out of 1 of 5 years that the cow guys are using CRP as an emergency forage, either as grazing or as haying. So they're not opposed to putting iron equipment on that to get the forages they need to winter the cow herd. The third was the grazing. If we do have water potential, if they're close to the house, or if we can develop watering scenarios, we put a grazing scenario on those 3 cover crop designs. The idea is that we can grow amazing, tremendous warm season crops in this area. But the question is how much water use we want to dedicate to that forage production. If we're going to put a warm season crop, and this is from a parallel cover crop trial and what grows, where it grows, and on a fallow production, and you can see that there's some pretty tremendous warm seasons. But we're dedicating that fallow moisture that year to 100% forage production. So there's going to be a yield drag probably the following year compared to your fallow. Taking into account insurance changes in the cropping systems and production that way. So we're actually targeting, as a beef guy, I'm targeting high quality forage, but trying to preserve any kind of deep subsoil moisture. So we actually targeted that when that cool season cereal heads, is to cut the forage down. A lot of the data throughout Montana and the western region show that that's a very happy medium of high quality and high yield potentials in annual forage. So that's what we're going to target, possibly allowing that 24 to 48 inches subsoil moisture to be there for the following wheat crop to generate our cash crop the following year. Kind of roughly our design project here, as you can see the cover crops and a monoculture of barley going away from the screen. We went ahead and put winter wheat and spring wheat back in as a response variable to the cover crop after we split those plots. So we have each one of those responses there to look at those termination endpoints. You can take a quick look at this. Most of our variations are not very creative and not very alternative or out there exotic. We wanted to make sure we had something that would grow in northern Montana. We had parallel studies that were looking at mung beans and other things and soybeans to look at the biomass production, but it didn't make much sense to do that without generating some kind of production. A 14 polyculture mixture is outstanding, but if it's all dominated by the cool season cereals, it doesn't do us much good, in my opinion, if it's all choked out by the oats or the barley or the triticale. So we used where we could classify this not only as different cocktails and mixes, but then we grouped these in three separate main categories of cool-warm blends. Here's an example of what we have here. We actually have two fields we've been looking at. We call them B2 and B3, but you can see on the one side, I'm going to risk it, Perry, you can see over here. On this side, you can see in our off year, you can see the winter wheat and spring wheat, and you actually see the winter wheats are starting to turn and ripen. And in this field right here where this crop is, we're looking at a six-year study. We're just trying to wrap this up now. We hope we'll have all the data at the end of 2018. But you can actually, if you look really hard, you can actually see waves in the winter wheat here. Can everybody kind of see that? Where the cover crops were perpendicular to the wheat yields. And so something's happening, whether it be a water response or not. Herbicide treatment, we actually grazed these in that early July period. Maybe not the most conducive. If I were to have a beef producer in me or somebody else wave their magic wand and say, agronomist, we want this, it would be an early spring broadleaf that we could plant in the fall, come back and graze to give our native range 2 to 3 weeks more time as we turn our pears out to extend that grazing period a little longer. I think it's been fairly well documented if we have irrigation that a secondary crop under irrigation that we can get up and germ and grow throughout August up until September makes perfect sense to put our calves on bloom, produce that high quality forage in the fall. But we're trying to break in to the triangle area of fallow where moisture drives the system. So you can see that there was very, very good agreement that we did target high quality forages here. Just to give you an idea of what the forage quantity is, or forage quality is, on the left you can see our cool season cocktails and mixes. I pooled these versus pulling out each individual mix. As you can understand, the interactions were significant. There is cool seasons that do better than others for forage quality and biomass, but you get caught up in some of the minutia that it gets things get a little confusing. But you can see a 14 protein, an ADF of 35.7. We can winter cattle all the way through the last trimester on that kind of hay, should we put it up as a hay or a quality forage. When you look at the cool warm season, which is in the maturity stage, probably in between the cool and the warm, because I said we're targeting the cool heading season, you can see that represents that 18% protein, which is probably bringing in some of those smaller plants, some of their younger warm season plants, which is proof positive. If you look at the warm seasons, we're pushing 21.6. In comparison to a forage barley cut at the same time that we have here, you can see that down below. One thing I want to point out to you is to take a look at some of these nitrates that we're seeing on these crops. Now, as a beef cattle producer, this makes me a little nervous. Some of the very earliest documented case of nitrate toxicity in literature is when we turned out cattle on droughted out corn. Killed all the cattle, then we figured out what's going on. We went through all the studies to figure out what the limits were in cattle. So to say a grazing animal can buffer themselves, by all means. But if we're not telling producers that we need to be cognizant of this kind of toxicity, we need to be a little think about that as a beef cattle producers. We take these cool seasons and warm seasons and let them go all the way till there's a killing frost. So mid-July, if we let them stand, continue using moistures, generate seed, viable seed in their head, and you do a killing frost, you can see what happens to the protein quality goes down dramatically after that killing frost. Doesn't mean it's not a high quality forage, it's just not as high a quality. So if we're putting it up for hay, you got to wonder, do we need all that viable seed back on our ground? Are wheat producers going to tolerate if there's any kind of dormancy in those seeds or anything else? Think about a vetch. Think about maybe oats that most wheat producers in the state of Montana are not really excited about. Here you can see, actually, we didn't have always rosy things happening with our cover crops either. You can see Perry data here. You can see a cool season on the left. You can see a cool, warm blend on the right. And you can see what happened on that late seeded date of our warm seasons. And we went ahead and seeded them appropriately for each one of the seeding dates. It doesn't make much sense in northern Montana to put a warm season in as early in April as we can, because we're going to kill it out with a frost somewhere anyways, right? But you can see that this crop did germ, but it died in a furrow. Absolutely just couldn't get going. And dig down there, there was moisture deeper. It just couldn't get down far enough to sustain growth. A little bit about the soils. We're still sifting through the soil health, the chemical and physical properties of this large trial. And when I say large trial, when we send soil samples out, it's 308 samples every time we take a soil sample down to three depths. Then we're taking 0 to 6 for modern type microbial analysis that we're working with various scientists in here. But so to get a rough idea of our infiltration weights, and to think about, we had 7 people laying in the field reading these micropore infiltrometers, Rydecagon, 3 people writing them down, walking through the field. It still took us 9 hours to get through there in one day before that weather pattern may have changed or whatever post-cover crop. And so it was the best way we had, without doing a double infiltration test immediately, to get a rough idea of what we're seeing after 3 full rotations, 6 years, 3 full rotations. We haven't seen any difference in infiltration rate. Okay. Along with that, you know, the grossest parameter we could probably look is that we didn't see any difference in our soil bulk density. And I see I didn't even catch this till just now. Our soil bulk density had no difference. But when we look at organic matter, when we started the trial, we were right at 1.4. Right now, we're right about 1.2. So no change in organic matter. Now, that's pretty good compared to some of the systems I heard in the talks yesterday and today. It's 30 years of adaption of no-till and chem-till. So we've worked on that organic matter process over the years. But then I hear people say, well, we should expect 8% organic matter by implementing our cover crops. And perhaps that's the case when we're roller crimping a 4-ton triticale crop back into the soil along with corn that is producing 190 bushels, and we're chopping that residue to go back on there. We don't have that kind of residue system in Montana. Our native range just south of our cover crops, and this has not been grazed by a native ungulate for over 100 years, wild ungulates can get into it, but it has not been grazed, only has an organic matter of 2.8. This is a mixed grass prairie and a normal sagebrush type of climax community. So how can we expect anything more if we're trying to mimic the natural ecosystems of the mixed grass prairie? I don't think it's realistic in our point. I think we're heading in a good direction, but maybe we should be targeting this 3%, looking at their bacterial populations, looking at their root morphology, and going backwards the other way. So as we think about fallow and crop fallow, and we've had this discussion, and trust me, I'm a beef guy talking to a lot of grain guys in the Triangle. So there's not a lot of beef production right in Hill County, but so I'm trying to justify how we implement this. And so I think of it as, and these guys, I've had people tell me that every time we fallow a crop in the Triangle, we fail. I don't think so. It's not necessarily my opinion. I think over time, we've developed a system of a 2-year system. Okay? You can't think on 1-year failure. You have to think on a 2-year success. The downsides, the producers and the implementation that Perry talked about, I think the downsides of that failure of the wheat crop is far better than the upsides of a continuous cropping. And I think most of the producers would say that, and some of the early literature would kind of go that way. But what's changed over time? And I think about when we had a large integrated pest management, Perry was a part of, Northern Ag Research Center, a lot of scientists were involved with integrated pest management in the mid to late 90s, where we diversified wheat operations by increasing continuous cropping pulses, perennial forages, alfalfa, and either cropping every year, flex cropping two out of every three years, and we diversified and implemented with both with forages and other types of crops. We were cutting 14 bushel wheat crops along with failures in the lentils and failures in that. So it's not just necessarily about timing of weather patterns and other things, it's how we go about it, I think. So I came into cover cropping very pessimistic because of the late 90s, and we saw a lot of people that diversified and continuous crop almost go out of business because of the weather patterns we were in. So I tried to represent a 2-year cycle with this graph here, and Bear with me because it might be a little confusing. We have all of our cocktails and mixes and barley and fallow on the top and bottom. You can represent those by the blue, the warm seasons by the orangish, and the cocktails by the mixes here. I pooled their yields, both on above-ground biomass and our grain yields. But what I say is, as we start thinking about a two-year period, I want you to think about that the yellow bar here is one field. So we have our above-ground biomass in B2, and we have the subsequent wheat yield the following year, whether it be winter or spring wheat. Look at our fallow, for instance, in the traditional fallow system. We can see that we had some pretty substantial wheat yields that year. But then you can see the yield drag. No matter what cover crop, whether it be a cool season up here on top, had a yield drag of not quite half, to ones that were warm seasons that produced less biomass, you can substantially less biomass, but had a little bit less, possibly more grain yield than that. This is highly variable, but there is significance throughout. Standard errors are down below. Then you think about what we look at crop year. And so Perry mentioned we have 30.6 centimeters for our crop year. And in crop, we're looking at 18 centimeters. So the reason I put in crop there is it goes to show that strategic rains are probably as much driving both our wheat yield and our cover crop yields in even poor years. A good example is this year. We had a very poor drought. We got about an inch of rain, to a little over 4 centimeters of rain. In that late June period, the wheat was able to make use of that, produce an adequate wheat yield. Okay, so strategic rains are also a big part of that, and that's what I tried to bring out on this component here. You can see that in all the years, when we look at the crop year, really the only 2 years is 2014, 2015, that we had decent crop years that are what we call average, if there's such a thing in a triangle. Then our in-crop ranged from 12 and 19 centimeters, right around there. And you can see if you look at those overwintering, we can see the future biomass and the drag in the wheat compared to some of that or lack thereof. So essentially when we're talking about cover crops and our wheat yields is that the cool seasons, as you would think, because they produce the largest amount of biomass, had the highest water used, again, the highest above-ground biomass, and they had the greatest impact on the wheat drag. Versus if you look at the warm seasons, which are just getting going, June 10, they want to start growing. This is when they really want to start making, hey, we're cutting them down. Okay, the below ground, we're not measuring at this point. We do have new scientists working with mini rhizotrons and looking at, but the past 2 years, I got to say, been unbelievably disappointing in the lack of root growth that we're seeing in these mini rhizotons. Either we're doing something wrong or the below ground biomass is nothing compared to what we're seeing in other areas in the United States. It's not to say we're not seeing root growth, but we're not seeing all, we're seeing one root if we're lucky and some branches off that and some fibers. So more needs to be worked on the below ground biomass of what's happening here. And again, these warm seasons are least impact on the cash crop because of the above ground biomass. So Perry talked about economists, and one of the goals was to try and figure out how to pencil in this. And what I want to show here is these are gross returns. This has not had any economist playing with any of the numbers. I encourage that, and that's why we did this study. So we'll hand it off to Anton and his crew here after this next wheat yield because we want to see what they start accounting to every one of these things. So let's take a look at just when we look at just the cocktails that we have here and the gross cash returns. Two full year cover crops on the far right. We can see what fallow would be on a 2 year return. Okay. And when we look at the main effects of whether it was mowed and hayed, whether it was grazed, or there was chemical termination, and you can see that the mowing and haying is substantially higher on a 4 year return than the grazing and the chemical. Now look back over here to where our fallows is, somewhere around this area, right? Well, we know if we put machinery on that field, we put a swather, we put a baler, we got at least $35 a ton, if not closer to $45 a ton. Producers know that. But if you need the forage bad enough, I don't think that opportunity cost is what we're accounting for as well as we can when economists start penciling out. I don't know a beef producer that doesn't depreciate their electric fence the very first year. It's a pretty minor investment for the most part, and the next 4 years he doesn't have to invest in electric fence. So how do we account for that as an economic valuation if we're getting into cover crops and playing that kind of game? So if that makes sense, and one thing about it, we did put winter wheat and spring wheat. I keep talking about the winter wheats, but the spring wheats in our country tended to take the hits to grain yields a lot harder by putting cover crops or forages ahead of them, simply because the heat hits them a little bit more than that early season winter wheat that's able to handle it a little bit better. So I guess the recommendations right now is that. One of the things they want me to do is talk a little bit about recommendations. We manage our cover crops as a crop. So we put a 20-20-20 down. I want that cover crop to absolutely be the strongest thing there is. So we put it down with a double shoot drill. We put a little 20-20-20 off to the right and down below so it can compete with the weeds. You can see most of the times we may not even have row closure. So why not make that the most vigorous, strongest crop there is? Okay, we're not seeing any differences in protein that we may expect. We fertilize all the same when we put our wheat down roughly for a 45 bushel crop. If you're trying to, you know, I always tell people, let's go backwards. We want to start decreasing the amount of fallow. We probably want to start doing our best to increase, decrease the amount of erosion, wind erosion, whatever we're seeing that way. So if you want to put 100% or increase your organic matter, maybe you should be thinking about putting 100% of your biomass back down to the soil. Our data doesn't support that yet. But how many years did it take us to recover from dragging iron for all those years? It's taken us 30 years to get back to 1.5% organic matter from probably a half or one, depending on who they were and what they are. Our systems are very slow to react, very slow timing. So what we're seeing maybe in a 5 or 6 or shorter time frame in these high rainfall, high biomass areas, it's going to take us 20 to 30 years to make changes. So you have to be in for a long haul. So my thought is why is the goal of a cover crop? Think backwards. Is it to graze? Is it to make up for a limited amount of forage you're already expecting? You're taking out CRP that you've been able to graze 1 out of 5 years. So let's think about when we want to graze it. Do we want to graze with our calves? Do we want to graze with our cows? Do we want to target that July 10 where we're in between pasture moves, get a great strong flush on her calves as we give them pre-vaccination shots so they're healthy, they're ready to take that immune challenge and build those titers? Possibly. Think about the goal, not just necessarily how to implement. Do we need to replace hay? We've tried to work with integrated pest managements. We've used oats in our cereals instead of barley. Working with entomologists to document the IPM effects of wheat stem sawfly. If it's an attractant, why not use that to try and decrease the populations of wheat stem sawfly? I think one of the huge recommendations, if you're going to do this, you can't be in it for the 1 year. This has got to be in for the long haul. Maybe you look at targeted areas. Maybe you look at recharge areas and saline seeps that are becoming more and more prevalent in Montana because we're taking out CRP or these forages that we're able to pull these forages down. Target specific areas and how you want to go about it and do it. I would argue that in our area, you got to be a little more tolerant of weeds. The weed guys are not very happy about that. As a beef guy, most of the time, unless it's exceptionally high in nitrates, I don't worry so much about it as long as we're not returning those weeds back to the field. But the agronomists on station do not appreciate the cover crop research because we're seeing more Russian thistle and possibly wild oats. So don't expect organic matter responses immediately in a low residue system. Had some outstanding fundings, and I'm going to give a plug out to all the experiment station directors, NEPA, USDA, is I think long-term we need to figure out how to start funding long-term research throughout the United States. I think that's one thing that we scramble, and I think every talk I've heard that has a long-term project, we scramble every 2 years to find funding to maintain these. And I think if there's one other thing I could thank our people for. So thank you, Pat.
Thank you.